From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
So do you believe that we are currently winning in Iraq?
No, sir.
Robert Gates has been unanimously confirmed by the Senate Armed Services Committee to be the next Secretary of Defense. We'll play highlights of the hearing. Then the Supreme Court weighs in on school integration.
Because segregation is harmful. Integration, as this court has recognized in Swan and the first Seattle case, has benefits.
Well, but
the district was assiduously.
It seems to me you're saying you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs.
We'll host a debate on school desegregation, and we'll talk to conservative British member of parliament who's come to the United States to challenge the practice of extraordinary rendition. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Senate Armed Services Committee has unanimously approved the nomination of Robert Gates as the next Secretary of Defense, in a stark contrast to his four-month confirmation hearings to become Director of Central Intelligence in 1991. Gates' hearing lasted just a day. In the session's most controversial moment, Gates was questioned by incoming Senate Armed Services Committee Chair Carl Levin.
Mr. Gates, do you believe that we are currently winning in Iraq?
No, sir.
Gates later clarified his remarks and said the U.S. is neither winning nor losing the Iraq war. The hearing came on a day when more than 60 people were killed in shootings and car bomb attacks in Iraq. Gates' nomination now goes to the full Senate for a confirmation vote as early as today. He is widely expected to win approval. More from the hearings after headlines. The bipartisan Iraq Study Group releases its long-awaited report today. In a new development, The Washington Post reports the panel will recommend President Bush threaten the Iraqi government with a reduction of economic and military support if it fails to meet specific goals on improving security. The Washington Post also reports many of the Iraq Study Group's advisors have concluded the war in Iraq is already lost. In July, a draft report said, quote, there's even doubt any level of resources could achieve the administration's stated goals. That wording has been removed. While the Iraq Study Report is being hailed as the dawn of a change of course, Iraqis are voicing skepticism. This is Iraqi citizen Ali Al-Dulaimi.
The study that James Baker submitted is doomed to fail because he's a Republican, and he participated in the blockade of Iraq that lasted for 12 years. He's now aiming at establishing basics that will support the Iraqi army. On the contrary, he is damaging the Iraqi army, and we are demanding the pullout of the U.S. forces from Iraq.
Meanwhile, the incoming House Intelligence Committee Chair, Democratic Congressmember Sylvester Reyes, says he will call for sending more troops to Iraq. Reyes initially opposed the invasion. His appointment this week was seen as a sign Democrats plan on challenging the Bush administration's Iraq policy. But in an interview with Newsweek, Reyes says he wants to see an increase of up to 30,000 troops to dismantle Iraq's militias. In other Iraq news, the New York Times is reporting at least five Marines are expected to be charged in the killing of 24 Iraqis in the town of Haditha last year. The Marines initially claim 15 civilians died in a roadside blast caused by insurgents. Months later, reports emerged the civilians were killed when Marines burst into their homes and shot them dead in their nightclothes. Charges could come as early as today. In Afghanistan, five Afghans and two Americans were killed today in a suicide bombing in Kandahar. The bombing hit the offices of a private American security firm. In Mexico, leaders of the popular uprising in the state of Oaxaca are vowing to continue their struggle in the face of the arrest of Flavio Sosa. Sosa was arrested Monday in Mexico City after announcing the Popular Assembly of the Oaxacan People, or APO, planned to hold negotiations with the government of Felipe Calderon. He's now being held in a maximum security prison. This is APO lawyer Israel Ochoa Lara.
This stage we are living in is the moment of government oppression against everything this movement represents. This doesn't mean the movement is over or has been taken down. What's happening is that the government has gone on the offensive with the intent of disarming the movement, and that's why the most visible activists have been persecuted.
The Mexican government has yet to explain why Sosa was arrested just hours before he was to meet state officials. In other Oaxaca news, the release of two suspects linked to the killing of American journalist Brad Will is coming under international criticism. One of the suspects is a municipal official with close ties to Oaxaca State Governor Ulysses Ruiz. In a statement, the group Reporters Without Borders said, quote, "Everything suggests the Oaxaca State judicial authorities are now trying to cover up for the governor's aides. This is an insult to the victim and a spur to impunity." In Venezuela, President Hugo Chavez read a congratulatory note from Cuban President Fidel Castro Tuesday on Chavez's win in the Venezuelan elections.
"Your victory was like something seen on few occasions, overwhelming and without parallels in the history of our America. The oppressed people of the world will always appreciate the strategy and courage that you used to win this difficult battle of ideas. Your political achievement and the people of Venezuela have moved the world. The Cubans are happy. A big hug, Fidel Castro. Thank you, Fidel."
Chavez has won the Venezuelan presidency with 63% of the vote. It was his highest victory share to date and the most in any Latin American election over the past year. In Fiji, the top Fijian military commander has declared a state of emergency and installed a new prime minister. The move comes one day after the overthrow of Fiji's elected government, Fiji's fourth coup in 20 years. The coup's drawing international condemnation and sanctions. This is Chief United Nations spokesperson Stefan Dujarric.
The Secretary General strongly deplores the seizure of power in the Republic of Fiji by the military leadership. The Secretary General calls for the immediate reinstatement of the legitimate authority in Fiji and its return to constitutional rule through peaceful means and inclusive dialogue.
Here in New York, the two survivors of the police shooting that killed the unarmed bridegroom, Sean Bell, are disputing the police version of events. In an interview with the television station New York One, Trent Benefield denied police assertions that a fourth man was inside Sean Bell's car. Benefield spoke Tuesday after his release from the hospital. He was treated for three gunshot wounds in his legs. Benefield said, quote, "My friend's dead. I'm shot up. We need justice." Meanwhile, the other survivor, Joseph Guzman, says police failed to identify themselves before they opened fire. Guzman says he was shot 16 times. The Council on American-Islamic Relations is calling on the Bush administration to remove a right-wing talk show host from a taxpayer-funded Council on Holocaust Awareness. The broadcaster, Dennis Prager, has drawn controversy for stating Congressmember Keith Ellison should be sworn into Congress using a Christian Bible instead of the Quran. Ellison is the first Muslim ever elected to Congress. Prager said using the Quran would, quote, "undermine American civilization and be like using a copy of Hitler's Mein Kampf." The Bush administration recently appointed Prager to a five-year term on the United States Holocaust Memorial Council. And finally, in health news, New York City has become the first in the country to ban trans fats from most restaurants and fast food chains. This is New York City Health Commissioner Thomas Friedman.
"That trans fats increase your risk of heart attack, stroke, and death, and they don't have to be there. So it's important that we eliminate them, and we've made tremendous progress in doing that. I think just from having this debate, we've seen a number of the national chains removing trans fat. We have much more information about it. And I'm confident that most items sold by July of next year will not have trans fat. And that's going to mean that New Yorkers live longer and healthier lives."
Fast food chains, including McDonald's and Burger King, that have yet to eliminate trans fats will have until July of next year before facing penalties. The ban was passed after several food companies failed to meet voluntary benchmarks to reduce trans fats. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Senate Armed Services Committee has unanimously approved the nomination of Robert Gates to be the next Secretary of Defense. Gates testified before the committee Tuesday that the U.S. is not winning the war in Iraq and that all options remain on the table for dealing with that war. In a 21-0 vote, the committee approved him to replace Donald Rumsfeld, who quit last month and amid criticism of Iraq policy. Gates' nomination now goes to the full Senate for a confirmation vote, which could be held as early as today. He's expected to win approval. In his opening statement Tuesday, Gates made it clear he would make Iraq his highest priority.
"I am under no illusion why I am sitting before you today for the war in Iraq. Addressing the challenges we face in Iraq must and will be my highest priority if confirmed.
The hearing came on a day when more than 60 people were killed in shootings and car bomb attacks in Iraq. Three U.S. soldiers were also killed. Gates went on to say he was open to new ideas in Iraq, but warned the situation there could lead to a wider regional conflict.
While I am open to alternative ideas about our future strategy and tactics in Iraq, I feel quite strongly about one point. Developments in Iraq over the next year or two will, I believe, shape the entire Middle East and greatly influence global geopolitics for many years to come. Our course over the next year or two will determine whether the American and Iraqi people and the next president of the United States will face a slowly but steadily improving situation in Iraq and in the region, or will face the very real risk and possible reality of a regional conflagration. We need to work together to develop a strategy that does not leave Iraq in chaos and that protects our long-term interests in and hopes for the region. I did not seek this position or a return to government. I'm here because I love my country and because the President of the United States believes I can help in a difficult time.
During the hearing, the incoming chair of the Armed Services Committee, Senator Carl Levin, listed for Gates what he said were the Bush administration's failures in Iraq.
The situation in Iraq has been getting steadily worse, not better. Before the invasion of Iraq, we failed to plan to provide an adequate force for the occupation of the country or to plan for the aftermath of major combat operations. After we toppled Saddam Hussein in 2003, we thoughtlessly disbanded the Iraqi army and also disqualified tens of thousands of low-level Ba'ath Party members from future government employment. These actions contributed to the chaos and violence that followed and to alienating substantial portions of the Iraqi population. We have failed so far to secure the country and defeat the insurgency. And we have failed to disarm the militias and create a viable Iraqi military or police force. And we have failed to rebuild the economic infrastructure of the country and provide employment for the majority of Iraqis. The next Secretary of Defense will have to deal with the consequences of those failures.
The Senate hearing on Robert Gates' nomination began a day before the Iraq Study Group releases its findings. Gates served on the panel until he was nominated. Arizona Republican and presidential hopeful John McCain has been calling for additional troops to be sent to Iraq. During Tuesday's hearing, McCain questioned Gates about troop levels and asked him again to clarify whether he thought the U.S. is winning the war.
We are not winning the war in Iraq. Is that correct?
That is my view, yes, sir.
And Therefore, the status quo is not acceptable.
That is correct, sir.
I know you did a great deal of work with the Iraq Study Group, and there is a general consensus of opinion now, in hindsight, that we didn't have sufficient number of troops at the time of the invasion to control Iraq, either Anbar province, the looting, most importantly, the weapons and ammunition depots that were looted at the time. And when anarchy prevails, it's very difficult to gain control of a country. Do you agree that at the time of the invasion, we didn't have sufficient troops to control the country in hindsight?
Well, I've had to deal with hindsight in some of the decisions that I've made, Senator McCain, and sometimes it's not very comfortable. I suspect in hindsight some of the folks in the administration probably would not make the same decisions that they made. And I think one of those is that there clearly were insufficient troops in Iraq after the initial invasion to establish control over the country.
And yet at this particular point in time, when the suggestion is made as the situation deteriorates and the status quo is not acceptable, that we reduce troops or, as General Abizaid said, that he had sufficient number of troops. In your study, when did we reach the point where we went from not having enough troops to having sufficient number of troops as the situation, boots on the ground, as the situation deteriorated? That's a non sequitur that I have yet found to, I'm unable to intellectually embrace.
Senator, I was a part of the Iraq study group during their education phase, I would say, and I resigned before they began their deliberations. I would tell you that when we were in Iraq, that that we inquired of the commanders whether they had enough troops and whether a significant increase might be necessary. And I would say that the answer we received was that they thought they had adequate troops. It seems to me that as one considers all of the different options in terms of a change of approach in Iraq and a change of tactics, that inquiring about this again is clearly something, and it may be that that a Secretary of Defense might get a more candid answer than an outside study group that was visiting them. But we certainly, the response that we received in Baghdad was that they had enough troops.
President Bush has continued to dismiss calls for withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. Michigan Democrat Carl Levin asked Defense Secretary nominee Robert Gates about the president's position.
I want to ask you about that statement of the president, which he's made twice in recent weeks. We are going to stay in Iraq as long as the Iraqis ask us to be there. Doesn't such an open-ended commitment send a message to the Iraqis that somehow or other it is our responsibility that as to whether or not they achieve a nation, rather than it is their responsibility to reach a political settlement?
Senator, I haven't spoken with the president about those remarks, so I'm going to have to interpret them myself. It seems to me that the United States is going to have some presence in Iraq for a long time. The Iraqi forces clearly have no logistical capability of their own. They have no air power of their own. So the United States clearly, even if whatever changed approach or strategy we come up with, the president implements, works, we are still going to have some level of American support there for the Iraqi military. And that could take quite some time, but it could be with a dramatically smaller number of U.S. forces than are there today. And so I would interpret the president's remarks in this vein, that we are willing to continue to help the Iraqis as long as they want our help. I don't think that it implies that we will be there in the at the level of force we have or doing the things that we are doing in a major combat way for the indefinite future.
Robert Byrd, the Senate's most senior member, broadened the discussion beyond Iraq, citing rumors of a possible U.S. military strike on Iran and Syria. The West Virginia senator bluntly questioned Gates on the issue.
Do you support? Now, we hear all these rumors about the potential for an attack on Iran due to its nuclear weapons program, or on Syria due to its support of terrorism. Do you support an attack on Iran?
Senator Byrd, I think that military action against Iran would be an absolute last resort, that any problems that we have with Iran, our first options should be diplomacy, and working with our allies to try and deal with the problems that Iran is posing to us. I think that we have seen in Iraq that once war is unleashed, it becomes unpredictable. And I think that the consequences of a conflict, a military conflict with Iran, could be quite dramatic. And therefore, I would counsel against military action except as a last resort and if we felt that our vital interests were threatened.
Do you support an attack on Syria?
No, sir, I do not.
Do you believe the president has the authority under either the 9/11 war resolution or the Iraq war resolution to attack Iran or to attack Syria?
To the best of my knowledge of both of those authorizations, I don't believe so.
Within 8 months of taking Baghdad, our troops captured Saddam Hussein. However, 5 years after 9/11 and the invasion of Afghanistan, Osama bin Laden is still on the loose. Who was responsible, Dr. Gates, in your judgment, for the 9/11 attacks? Saddam Hussein or Osama bin Laden?
Osama bin Laden, Senator.
Over the past 5 years, who has represented the greater threat to the United States? Saddam Hussein or Osama bin Laden?
Osama bin Laden.
How do you intend to catch Osama bin Laden?
Senator, I have no doubt that our forces have been trying their best to find Osama bin Laden. I'm not familiar with the effort that has been devoted to this over the past 2 or 3 years. I will say I think Osama bin Laden has become more of a symbol for jihadist terrorists than an active planner and organizer of terrorist attacks. In fact, one of the consequences of our success in Afghanistan has been the denial of that country as a place to plan these sophisticated terrorist operations, such as the attacks that took place on 9/11.
Senator Lindsey Graham also questioned Gates about the possibility of Iran acquiring nuclear weapons in the context of posing a threat to Israel.
Do you believe the Iranians are trying to acquire nuclear weapons capability?
Yes, sir, I do.
Do you believe the president of Iran is lying when he says he's not?
Yes, sir.
Do you believe the Iranians would consider using that nuclear weapons capability against the nation of Israel?
I don't know that they would do that, Senator. I think that the risks for them obviously are enormously high. I think that they see value.
If I may,
yes,
the president of Iran has publicly disavowed the existence of the Holocaust. He has publicly stated that he would like to wipe Israel off the map. Do you think he's kidding?
No, I don't think he's kidding. But I think that there are, in fact, higher powers in Iran than the president. And I think that while they are certainly pressing, in my opinion, for nuclear capability, I think that they would see it in the first instance as a deterrent. They are surrounded by powers with nuclear weapons, Pakistan to their east, the Russians to the north, the Israelis to the west, and us in the Persian Gulf.
Can you assure the Israelis that they will not attack Israel with a nuclear weapon if they acquire one?
No, sir. I don't think that anybody can provide that assurance.
Robert Gates' confirmation now goes to the full Senate for a vote, which could come as early as today. He's widely expected to win approval. When we come back from break, we'll talk about a parliamentary delegation from Britain that's come to the United States to speak with Congress members and other Bush administration officials about ending extraordinary rendition. We'll also have a debate in a Supreme Court case around the issue of school desegregation. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know.
really worth. It's an art that Peter is gold. After story had never been told. So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your right. Come on.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Get up, stand up. Bob Marley here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Italian prosecutors have asked a judge to indict 26 CIA agents accused of kidnapping an Egyptian Muslim cleric in Milan in 2003 and sending him to Egypt. Osama Mustafa Hassan, or Abu Ammar, has claimed he was tortured in detention in Egypt after his abduction in Italy. Those named in the request include former CIA station chiefs in Rome and Milan. Prosecutors also asked the judge to indict Italian agents over the case. If a trial is ordered, it would be the first criminal prosecution in the world over the U.S. practice known as extraordinary rendition. The news comes a week after a new report by the European Parliament has concluded 11 European countries cooperated actively or passively in extraordinary rendition. The investigation found more than 1,200 CIA flights went through European airspace or landed at one of its airports. This week, a conservative British member of Parliament arrived in the United States to meet with U.S. lawmakers and challenge this practice of extraordinary rendition. Andrew Tyrie is a Tory MP and chairman of All Parliamentary Group on Extraordinary Rendition. He joins us from Washington, D.C. And on the line from London is Stephen Gray, the award-winning investigative journalist first exposed the secret rendition program back in 2004. His new book is called Ghost Plane, the true story of the CIA torture program. He's just published more than 3,000 flight logs of suspected CIA-operated planes on his website. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Andrew Tyrie, let's begin with you. Why are you here in the United States?
I'm in the United States to put the case to the administration and on Congress that going ahead with this program, as it appears the Americans have been in the past, is not in America's interest, it's not in the West's interest, and we've got to bring it to a halt. It's not making us safer, it's making us less safe, it's alienating large sections of moderate Muslim opinion around the world, and I'm not even sure the information that's being collected in this way is of any practical use against the war on terror. If it is, we should be told that it is absolutely straight, that should be explained to our politicians, and then we should change the law to legalize this practice. I believe there's absolutely no stomach for doing that, and therefore we'd better try and stick to the law.
Who exactly have you met with in Washington?
I've been meeting with people in the administration, John Bellinger, Juan Zarate in the NSC, and a number of other people in the administration, putting this case to them. And what I get back from them is, I think, and I'm not attributing this to any individual person, but a recognition that maybe there was an overreaction after September the 11th. Totally understandable, but mistakes have been made, and now we've got to recover from those mistakes, and that means clarifying what's really gone on, having a congressional committee to inquire into this. We've got a committee inquiring into this in the United Kingdom at the moment. And then once we've found out what's going on, draw a line and say, we've made some mistakes, we're not going to make those mistakes again. And that way, we can win back the confidence of our own domestic publics in Europe, and we can also start to win the battle of ideas with moderate Muslims around the world, because that's the only way we're going to win this battle against terrorism.
Juan Zarate is the Assistant Secretary for Terrorist Financing.
Yes, he's the Deputy National Security Advisor on terrorism and an assistant to the President and very close to these issues.
In Treasury, also State Department official John Bellinger, Congress members.
I've seen Jim Moran and John Conyers and spoken to a good number of staffers from senators' offices It's clear that on the Hill there's also widespread concern about these issues, and I'm confident that at least one, if not more than one, congressional inquiries are going to be set up into this. And what we're going to have as a consequence is parallel inquiries taking place in various countries in Europe as well as on Capitol Hill. And I think between the two of them, I hope we can get to the bottom of this.
Congressmember Conyers, very significant, is the incoming chair of the Judiciary Committee. Did he say he will be holding hearings on extraordinary rendition?
I think he'll speak for himself. I could only tell you what, and I'm only happy to tell you what I told him. It's absolutely clear in my conversation with him that he's deeply concerned about these issues, that he recognizes what we're trying to achieve in our parliament, and that he sees every advantage in working together, as I do, to make sure we get to the bottom of this. I'd just like to say one more thing. I'm a British Conservative MP. I don't want to be soft on terror. I want to make our countries as secure as possible. I'm an Atlanticist. I want to work with the United States. I've always believed that's the way to make us secure, a strong Atlantic alliance. I'm very pro-American, but I'm confident that some big mistakes have been made, and now we've got to admit them and put them right. There's even bigger ones being made in Iraq, but there's some big mistakes being made here. The dark sites, Guantanamo Bay, extraordinary rendition. All of these things have been very counterproductive for dealing with terror, and we've got to reverse those policies, as I think quietly some in the administration are beginning already to acknowledge.
We're talking to Andrew Tyrie, a conservative member, a Tory member of the British Parliament. He's in D.C. right now, meeting with Bush administration officials and Congress members. Also joined by Stephen Gray on the line, award-winning investigative journalist, has contributed to the New York Times and Newsweek, the Atlantic Monthly, and many other publications, has set up a new website called ghostplane.net. Ghostplane is also the name of his new book, Ghostplane, the True Story of the CIA Torture Program. But on this website, Stephen Gray, you have posted more than 3,000 flight logs of suspected CIA-operated planes. Can you talk about the latest information since we last spoke to you that you have gathered?
That's right. I've been sitting on this information for quite some time, poring over it, and I used it, these flight logs, these thousands of routes taken by CIA planes since September 11th. To help me with the research for the book I wrote and all the work I've done on rendition. But I thought it was time to put that stuff out in the public domain for two reasons. First of all, to be absolutely clear, to deal with any critics who've said, how can you show these planes really are CIA planes? How can you prove what you've said? Since we last spoke, I think I said to you I named a company involved, Aero Contractors in North Carolina, as being the center of a CIA.
That's Aero, A-E-R-O.
That's right. And I mentioned that on the program last time, and that company issued a statement to the local newspaper saying I was clutching at straws, saying they were the CIA. Well, I thought that by publishing the information, it makes absolutely clear when you see all the operations and places these planes have been to at crucial moments, that these are U.S. government planes operating for the CIA. And I think that's very important because at this time, the U.S. government has acknowledged that the rendition program does exist, but it's actually acknowledged no individual rendition. And that means that people like Khaled al-Masri, you've heard from, the German citizen kidnapped in Macedonia, taken to Afghanistan to secret prison there, people like Meher Arar, the Canadian, taken from New York to Syria, all of these people who are claiming some justice or some explanation or for compensation are being told they can't get any answers because it's a state secret. So by publishing these proofs in the form of these flight logs, I'm showing that it's very, very clear. It's not a state secret. It's not secret information. It's absolutely clear that it was the CIA that was responsible for the transfer of people under this rendition program and for these specific cases. If I may, there's a second reason as well for publishing this information, which is it touches on what Mr. Tari was just saying about drawing a line under things. We can't draw a line under this whole program until we find out what's happened to all the hundreds, in fact, thousands of people that have actually disappeared in this whole program. And that goes beyond what I was talking to you about before, because there have been more than 5,000, in fact, 10,000 prisoners that were processed by the United States in Afghanistan after September 11th. And we don't know what's happened to all these people. We know that many, many people have disappeared. We know about 700 were sent to Guantanamo. We know that several hundred were rendered. But the rest of them, we know we can't be sure what's happened to them. And I wanted to publish as much information as possible showing the movement of these planes to see if we can try and pin down the fate of some people that have disappeared. Because I think unless we actually, you know, show what we've done with people, we can't really draw a line under this whole issue.
Stephen Gray, you mentioned Aero. What about other companies?
Well, Aero Contractors is a company that has been the real operators of a lot of these planes. There's another company down in Florida called Tepper Aviation, which has been, you know, for quite a long time worked with the CIA. They've also used cover names as they've traveled around. One is called Stevens Express Leasing, and that's based out of Memphis, Tennessee. Another was Premier Executive Transport of Massachusetts. But and the other thing that's come up since we spoke last, I think, is it's been clear that they made use of a perfectly normal but interesting subsidiary of Boeing called Jeppesen Data Plan, which is based out in San Jose in California. And they're involved in planning the movement of private jets around the world. And it's quite clear from sort of telegrams that I got hold of and which are published also on that website, you can see how they were responsible for organizing the movement of these planes in a particular rendition, the rendition of Khalid al-Masri. Now, these people, I have no information. They knew that they were being involved, you know, that they were actually organizing a rendition when they took instructions, you know, from the CIA to do these things. But clearly, they're going to be very, very interesting witnesses for these congressional inquiries to look at because, you know, these are private citizens who may have a lot of information about what these planes have been up to.
And the transport, Stephen Gray, of the interrogators from site to site.
Yes, well, you can see that in these flight logs. They don't just show the transfer of prisoners, but you can see every time there's a key detainee picked up around the world, that the plane takes off from Washington with straight to that location or to where we think they've taken this prisoner, including flights to, there's a flight there to Diego Garcia, for example, which is new, and that's in the Indian Ocean, and long denied as a place where they hold prisoners. But you can see every time someone's taken, including Saddam Hussein, a plane takes off taking interrogators. And there was even a claim by a detainee in Guantanamo that he was questioned by agents of the Libyan secret police in Guantanamo. Again, you might not believe it, but there was a flight from Libya to Guantanamo just the time when he said that this had happened. So in other words, suggesting it's true that they actually flew interrogators from Libya to take part in interrogations in Guantanamo.
We're talking to award-winning journalist Stephen Gray. His new book is Ghost Plane. Andrew Tyrie, what about holding corporations responsible? I know there's going to be a news conference that will be held in North Carolina by the ACLU that is setting up a petition to Governor Eastley calling for an investigation into the Aero Contractors, which is based in North Carolina, also named in the ACL lawsuit of Khalid al-Masri. What about companies like Boeing and Aero?
I think all those who have been involved in this, if they've broken the law, we need to investigate that, get to the bottom of it, and if necessary, prosecute. But I think it's very important that we get to the bottom of those who are actually responsible for authorizing the policy. And that is almost certain to be very senior people in the administration and in perhaps collaborating in other countries around the world. I want to add one other point, that while we have an administration that appears to be in a state of denial about this, it is natural that more and more lurid allegations of terrible things having happened will just escalate. It's only by an investigation and by getting to the truth that we can start to provide reassurance to people. The public, quite understandably, say, well, if someone's out there who means us harm, we'd better do something about it. Yes, and if necessary, we have to change the law to make sure we have the powers to do something about it. But doing things illegally, doing things behind a curtain, that's no way for a democracy to operate. The truth will out on all this. It's our job as the media and as politicians, and I salute Stephen Gray's investigative work, to help get to the bottom of this and make sure that we can draw a line on it and move on.
Andrew Tyrie, finally, the Italian prosecutor is asking a judge to indict 26 CIA agents accused of kidnapping an Egyptian Muslim cleric in Milan in 2003. Are we going to be seeing more prosecutions, possibility of prosecutions, possibly even in Britain?
Yes, I think that the next stage in all this is going to be a series of lawsuits of one type or another and possibly prosecutions, because almost certainly laws have been broken. And those laws will now be used to get to the bottom of what's happened. It's also worth pointing out that although there are some very nasty people in Guantanamo Bay that we've got to make sure stay secure there and find legal processes to ensure that, there are also a large number of people there who were innocent and who have had their lives completely wrecked. When they come out, hopefully they haven't been radicalized by the experience they've had. When they come out, many of them are going to seek justice by one means or another, and many of the people who have been rendered too. They will bring lawsuits. They will find ways of getting to the bottom of this and providing sunlight. Sunlight will be the best disinfectant for all this. We need more of it. We need Congress now that we have these investigations taking place and parallel investigations in Europe to undertake that process of providing more sunlight to all this and create the conditions in which we can restore public confidence in the way the war on terror is being conducted.
Andrew Tyrie, I want to thank you for being with us, a British Member of Parliament, Tory MP, chair of the All-Parliamentary Group on Extraordinary Rendition. He's in Washington, D.C., asking questions about the practice. Stephen Gray is on the line with us from Britain, award-winning investigative journalist. His book is called Ghost Plane. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, a debate on the Supreme Court case around school desegregation. Stay with us. Nina Simone, I wish I could know how it feels to be free. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM college and community radio stations. We're also broadcasting on public access TV and PBS TV stations and both TV satellite networks. On Dish Network, channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to the Supreme Court, which recently heard arguments in a pair of cases that could determine whether local governments can take measures to promote racially desegregated schools. Parents of white students in Seattle and Louisville sued their local school districts to challenge policies that considered race as a factor in determining what schools students attend. In both systems, students are offered a choice of schools but can be denied admission if enrolling at a particular school would upset the racial balance. Both desegregation plans were voluntarily enacted by the local school districts. The court's conservative majority seemed hostile to the school desegregation plans. The landmark 1954 Brown v. Board of Education case, which ruled segregated schools unconstitutional, was repeatedly brought up as evidence of the strict scrutiny that race-based plans must face. This is Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Scalia in an exchange with the Seattle District's lawyer, Michael Madden.
Sometimes students, in the end of the day, have an assignment determined by race. Just like in the university cases, at some point race will be a tipping factor. Different, though, we put someone in a basically comparable school.
Well, you're saying everyone got a seat in Brown as well. But because they were assigned to those seats on the basis of race, it violated equal protection. How is your argument that there's no problem here because everybody gets a seat distinguishable?
Because segregation is harmful. Integration, as this court has recognized in Swan and the first Seattle case, has benefits.
Well, but
the district was assiduously.
It seems to me you're saying you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs. Can you think of any other area of the law in which we say, whatever it takes, so long as there's a real need, whatever it takes? I mean, if we have a lot of crime out there, and the only way to get rid of it is to use warrantless searches, fudge on some of the protections of the Bill of Rights, whatever it takes, we got to do it.
That last comment was from Justice Scalia. The Bush administration filed a friend of the court brief for the white parents challenging the school districts. This is Justice Stephen Breyer responding to Solicitor General Paul Clement, who argued the Bush administration's position.
Go back to Cooper versus Aaron. Go back to the case where this court and paratroopers had to use tremendous means to get those children into the school. That's because the society was divided. Here, we have a society, black and white, who elect school board members who together have voted to have this form of integration. Why, given that change in society, which is a good one, how can the Constitution be interpreted in a way that would require us, the judges, to go in and make them take the black children out of the school? So my objection to your approach to the Constitution is primarily a practical one.
Supreme Court Justice Breyer. Ted Shaw of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and Todd Gaziano of the Heritage Foundation join us now in Washington, D.C. to debate the issue. Ted Shaw is the Director, Counsel, and President of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. Todd Gaziano is Director of the Center for Legal and Judicial Studies for the Heritage Foundation. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! And begin with Todd Gaziano. Your assessment of this case.
This case follows very much the principles of Brown versus Board of Education, that school districts' theories of the right racial mix is really a very dangerous one that the court needs to apply very strict scrutiny. And I should add that it wasn't just white parents and white students who were denied the school of their choice. It was minority parents. Over 100 in the Seattle school district, a third of those denied, were told that they couldn't go to the high school of their choice because it would make that school too minority in the view of some education bureaucrat. That's the kind of practice that we thought Brown versus Board of Education ended, and I think that's what the Supreme Court is going to say.
Ted Shaw, what's your assessment of this case?
Brown versus Board of Education wasn't about bureaucrats. Brown versus Board of Education was about a rigid system of segregation that followed from the Plessy versus Ferguson decision. It was about people being denied admission to schools because of their race, absolute segregation based upon the belief of racial superiority and inferiority. This case is about the last gasp of Brown versus Board of Education. Mandatory desegregation is all but dead. All that's left is voluntary integration efforts by school districts that want to maintain desegregated schools. And the fact is that the only way that's going to happen is if school districts are allowed to pursue it. To equate segregation with attempts to integrate is simply a false equation. It's a hijacking of the principles of Brown, standing it on its head, and a perversion of the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause.
What about Todd Gaziano's comment, Ted Shaw, that we're not only talking about white students saying they can't go to the school of their choice, but black students as well?
Well, 2 points. One is that school districts around this country routinely assign students to school, and most school assignments are not done on a voluntary basis, that is to say, with choice, although school districts are increasing choice opportunities. But the phenomenon that he's talking about is part of the most uncontroversial desegregation efforts, and that is to say If you have majority-to-minority transfer provisions like school districts did that allowed students, if their race was in the majority, to transfer to schools in which they were in a minority, that was integrative, and they did not allow the opposite, that is segregative assignments. That's the principle here. If an assignment is going to be segregative, then they may say no, because we value integrated education. That's an assignment that's not available to you. Make another choice that is integrative. If it's integrative, then it's okay. So it is not based upon the belief that any student is inferior. It doesn't stigmatize. It's about trying to maintain integrated education. And frankly, you can't do it any other way.
Todd Gaziano of Heritage Foundation, your response.
Well, I'm not sure what a lot of that means, that it doesn't harm the students or the parents who are denied the school of their choice. This is the fact of these so-called voluntary integration plans. They set these very hard quota bans. And if you're an Asian student, you're considered white in one district, you're considered a minority in the other. And the fact of the matter is, there are these rigid bans, and if you're a minority parent, you may get in some schools. If you're a minority parent or child, you won't get in others. And it'll be exclusively on the basis of race. You know, Justice Kennedy said, it's like saying everyone gets a meal. Everyone gets a meal. It's just that some get dessert and some don't. Everyone gets to, you know, a school, just like in Brown. But some get their choice, and some are told because of their race, they can't go to the school of their choice. That's discrimination. It's not a special kind of discrimination. It's the same kind of discrimination.
Todd Gaziano, do you see a trend here? You have Michigan voters recently approving a constitutional amendment banning affirmative action and public employment, public education, and state contracting. It was called the Michigan Civil Rights Initiative, pushing Proposal 2, prohibiting preferential treatment based on race, gender, color, ethnicity, or national origin.
Well, it's very encouraging that Americans, you know, for some time have been rejecting racial discrimination in all its forms, rejecting racial quotas, rejecting racial preferences. It's only some government bureaucrats who think they know the exact percentage of schools that are the problem. In these school districts, for example, there's no question they would all be integrated. In Seattle, for example, all this manipulation only results in about 2% change one way or the other. And it's for that reason that the bureaucrats want to force parents to make these or to reject their choices. But it's great that the people are rejecting that kind of nonsense.
Ted Shaw of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. Same question about the Michigan anti-affirmative action referendum that was just passed, as well as this case.
Let me make two points. First of all, let me throw away, or I think we should throw away, all these buzzwords that Todd knows triggers a certain kind of reaction, bureaucrats, quotas, et cetera. This isn't about that. This is about whether or not we're going to continue to make progress on issues of race in this country. And what our adversaries have done is hijack the language of the civil rights movement, like in the Michigan Civil Rights Initiative, and they are advocating a kind of colorblindness, which is, again, a hijack of the term colorblindness. What they're really doing is trying to gouge out our eyes so we can't do anything about continued racial inequality, which is still existing as a consequence of our long history of discrimination, particularly against African Americans. Let me make no mistake about this. The edge on all of this is still along the black-white divide, even though we are a multiracial society and everybody's affected by it. The Michigan Civil Rights Initiative is going to mean that the government in Michigan, the University of Michigan, will not be able to make efforts to enroll minority students on a conscious basis, will not be able to try to get minorities involved in contracting where they are underrepresented. And this is part of a much larger effort to make it illegal and unconstitutional in this country to voluntarily and consciously do anything about racial inequality. That's their bottom line. So at the end of the day, whether we're talking about scholarships for minority students, pipeline programs into corporate America, programs that are outreach, you know, to get people involved in opportunities they otherwise wouldn't have. They're on the chopping block in the crosshairs of these right-wing ideologues, and what they're trying to do is stop all voluntary attempts to do anything about racial inequality in this country. That's the bottom line. We should be clear about it.
And Justice David Souter's comment that school systems must hide the ball to seek racial diversity without relying on race, Ted Shaw?
Well, you know, Justice Souter was pointing out too that there's a kind of an anomalous part of these arguments, or even a hypocrisy. That is to say, our adversaries tell us that you can do this in any other way, but you cannot do it because of race, because race becomes this third rail given our experience. Well, you're telling African Americans who were at the butt end of slavery and segregation that only ended segregation four decades ago in any serious way, that race is the third rail, and therefore you cannot consider race, even if it means consideration of race to address continued racial inequality. Justice Souter was saying, look, let's not play games. We should honestly and openly be able to address racial inequality, and the only way you can do that with certainty is to do it consciously, and to equate racial integration efforts with racial segregation is a dishonest approach. And he doesn't want any part of it, neither should the American people.
Let me put this question to Todd Gaziano of Heritage Foundation, looking at a Pew piece about how this issue presents a unique challenge to Louisville schools, which spent a quarter of a century under a court order to eliminate the effects of state-sponsored segregation. The Jefferson County, Kentucky School Board, which encompasses Louisville, decided to keep much of the court-ordered plan in place to prevent schools from segregating again. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the Supreme Court Justice, said what's constitutionally required one day is constitutionally prohibited the next. That's very odd, she said, a sentiment shared by three of her liberal colleagues. Your response?
Well, school districts, of course, have a requirement to remedy their past discrimination. And when, after many decades, a school system like Louisville is told that they have remedied the government's intentional discrimination, they can't then, you know, play by special rules and deny, as I say, minority parents and white parents, Asian parents, Hispanic parents, that they're going to continue their social engineering plan. What they were doing in Louisville was denying minority parents the choice. You can't create a system of choice and then say, this minority parent's going to get their choice of school, this minority parent isn't. This Hispanic parent and child is going to get their choice, and this Asian parent is and is not. That's the same type of discrimination in the old system. It's just a new theory. And the courts need to be equally skeptical of all uses of race. And this is what the school boards need to do. The school boards need to be required to bring up all schools so that parents will not be so passionate about trying to get to one school over another. That's the real challenge of America today.
Well, I would agree with
Ted Shaw, we just have 10 seconds.
Yeah, I would agree with the last point, although with all due respect, Todd has made a number of misrepresentations in both cases. The bottom line is that Brown wasn't about desegregating schools for a moment when the courts can take a snapshot and then allowing them to return to segregation. That's what his argument and the arguments of our opponents allow these school districts to do. And the equation of segregation and integration as the same thing is fundamentally wrong.
We're going to leave it there. Ted Shaw of NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund, Todd Gaziano of the Heritage Foundation, thanks so much for being with us. On Friday night, I'll be in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Look forward to seeing people there. DemocracyNow.org is our website. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Sharif Abdel-Kandous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.